Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore. Earlier this year, I had a conversation with someone after an event that I was speaking at. He was a Life and Faith fan, he told me, and he asked me, why don't you guys have more philosophers on? I don't know if philosophers are everybody's cup of tea or shot of whiskey, maybe. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those people who I really think that I like philosophy, but then secretly, you know, a philosopher starts talking and I'm like, what are we talking about again? I'm a little bit lost.
Yes, although this depends a lot, of course, on who the philosopher is.
This is true.
Today is that listener's lucky day, because not only do we have Scottish philosopher John Haldane on, but he's really someone who we could legitimately call a public intellectual. He's an academic philosopher for sure, but he's also really good at speaking into the public about big philosophical concepts, and he's really easy to listen to.
The accent helps, for me, anyway.
Yeah, sure. So I started by asking him about this question of accessibility and relevance. Are philosophers these days just an elite club talking to each other?
Well, I think the most striking feature of philosophy, generally speaking, today, is how it has become professionalized and exhibits the characteristics of modern professions, principally specialization. So to understand this, just think of the development of the sciences. You know, we start out on the basis of, say, something like chemistry. And then as this develops and our understanding develops, people become specialists in different parts of chemistry. And then within those parts, more knowledge is acquired, and then they split again into specialists about that. So people who are working, say, in contemporary biology or physics or chemistry at the leading level have relatively little to say to one another, across those disciplines. They just talk to a specialist group. Now, philosophy, like other subjects, I think, has taken on that character, partly because that's just the way in which universities work, but also because I think that philosophy has come to see itself as a kind of science. And so that's then what you would expect, these intensifications of specialism, for example, in the philosophy of language or logic or whatever it may be, social or political philosophy, more and more specialisms. But I would say that that is very much anathema, at odds with and ill fits the deepest traditions of philosophy. Because philosophy from its origins, certainly when it comes to be a sort of settled practice in the work of figures like Plato and Aristotle, through, I would say, to the 18th century, and maybe into the 19th century, has always had its focus on the idea that we investigate thought and the world and so on in order to answer the question, how ought I to live? And so philosophy has historically had an integrative ambition to bring things together to enable us to understand ourselves and how we should live. Whereas this diversification, this separation out into specialisms, tells against that. So of all subjects, specialism poses a particular threat to philosophy, because it fragments philosophical knowledge and takes it further away from answering those two fundamental questions: what is the nature of human beings and how ought they to live?
Philosophy still is, and philosophers are very influential, often well down the track from what they're writing about in education systems, people's worldviews are influencing that. So that poses a kind of challenge, I suppose, for philosophers themselves, but also for the people who might end up being influenced by them.
Well, I maybe want to question a little bit part of the assumption that philosophers have influence. I mean, some do, and that's, well, not always been the case, but that remains the case to some extent today. But I think that what's significant is the way in which philosophy, to some extent, has been displaced by other kinds of things. So, for example, the metaphysical questions about the nature of reality and so on, which are traditionally part of philosophy, to some extent have been displaced by kind of popularizing science. So, you know, evolutionary psychology, you know, programs that one would see on television or listen to on the radio or on the internet and so on, podcasts and so on, which were really trying to sort of give a scientific view. That's a displacement of philosophy to a degree. I mean, I'm not saying science isn't important, but it can't answer everything. And then on the other side, on the ethical side, I think the rise of interest in psychology and personalities and social theories and so on, to some extent, is a displacement of philosophical thinking about that. And then we get, of course, through social media, just people chattering away and expressing their ideas, which they think of as being philosophical. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. So actually, I think the voice of authentic philosophy is being lost in the babble that is popular science, popular psychology, popular history, but then just the chatter of social media. So I think philosophy has to work to recover its place. You might say this, to recover its authority. And part of the way of doing that is to demonstrate the inadequacies of these other things. Not the inadequacy of science, but the inadequacy of the idea that science can be the answer to everything.
If philosophy is meant to be about the nature of humans and how they ought to live, I figured I should ask John about what it has to offer in this area of virtue and happiness and such things.
Interestingly, I think that the roots of this lie in something that revolutionary figures of the 19th century were very interested in. Here I might just mention Marx. I think that Marx saw a trajectory of capitalism into social life, not just into sort of economic relations, but into social life. And I think what we're seeing is something that Marx, in a sense, predicted, which is the marketization, if I can put it that way, rendering into markets of everything, right? So lifestyles, personal choices, and so on are all traded in the market that we call contemporary culture. And it's about, you know, people are trying to sell one another views about how they should live, or, as people often do in markets, try to coerce consumption in various ways by bringing on other pressures. So I think that the characteristics of contemporary affluent society is that people are highly individualistic, they're highly hedonistic, they seek pleasure in various sorts, and they think it's up to them to decide, you know, they're the consumers, they're the customers, so they'll decide what pleasures they want and will seek them in the marketplace, as it were. I think also people have become very narcissistic, that's to say they're very much in love with themselves. I think it's a feature of contemporary culture just how much people love themselves and their choices and their desires. Though, of course, that love, like everything else I've been talking about in this last couple of minutes, is very superficial. And so actually people have an idealized sense of themselves, but under that surface, the contortions and the distortions and the torment, as it were, are developing and brewing. So that, I think, in part accounts for the unhappiness. And in fact, I say the unhappiness is all the more profound because of the gap between people's idea of themselves and the reality.
Endless introspection or just focusing on yourself doesn't get you very far,
no,
it would seem.
I wouldn't even call it introspection. I'd call it looking in the mirror.
Yeah.
I
mean, not as deep as
it's
introspection.
It's not as deep as introspection.
Right. Yeah. Now, you're interested in the notion of virtue, which is probably related, I think, to what we're talking about here. But do people care about virtue these days? Should they?
Well, certainly they should. And I also think to a degree they do, because people praise one another or blame one another on the basis not just of what they do, but of their motivations and their ideas and their ways of thinking and their feelings and so on. So often we'll say of people's views, that's disgusting, or, you know, this view is very compelling or attractive and so on, or this seems to be a good person and such like. So we do judge not just what people do, but what kind of people they are. And when we get to the idea of what kind of people they are and the relationship between your character and your actions, we're in the territory of virtue. So I think that implicitly people still hold to the ideas of virtue and vice, of that in people which deserves to be praised and that in people which deserves to be blamed. What's happened, however, is that there's, first of all, there's a lack of awareness that that is what one is doing, but secondly, there's a lack of critical thinking about what the real virtues are. Because sometimes we can be attracted to rather superficial features of people. So I'll give an example of this. I mean, I think charm, for example, is an engaging quality, but it can be an incredibly shallow and superficial one.
than one that people see through fairly quickly.
Well, sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. That's the problem. But the idea that you can see through it, that it might just be on the surface, already means that people have a sense of what we might call the deep value of human beings as opposed to just the superficial things. So I don't think the notion of virtue is in trouble. What I think is in trouble is understanding how virtue is acquired, how virtue is formed, how it's retained, how virtue involves getting in line your actions, your feelings, your motivations, and so on, your choices. And that isn't a trivial matter. That's something that really does need working out, both at the level of thinking and at the level of practice.
Historians might like to point to, especially Christian historians, the way in which things that our culture think are self-evidently virtuous have come from, in large part, the Christian story. What is thought for humility, for instance, might be an example of that.
Yes, I mean, I think actually I'd want to go deeper. I think that obviously Christianity has contributed massively to our thinking about human character and so on. But the roots of this in Western civilization begin before Christianity. They begin in Greek philosophy. I mean, the Trinity of philosophy, as opposed to the Trinity of Christian faith, is really Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. That's where it begins. I was in Athens about 2 months ago, and I was standing where Socrates would have walked, and where Plato walked, and where Aristotle walked, and so on. And I was, you know, obviously I'm a philosopher, so I know about these things, but I was just, it was a certain vividness of imagination and thinking of these people debating and discussing virtue. They came to a view about the virtues, the principal four virtues, sometimes called the cardinal virtues, that what every human being needs is courage, is temperance, an ability to resist desires in certain circumstances, justice, how they deal with others, and prudence or practical knowledge about how to live. So that fourfold root predates Christianity. But what Christianity adds then is another set of virtues, the so-called theological virtues of faith, of hope, and in charity. So I think when you put together, you know, justice, courage, temperance, and prudence, plus faith, hope, and charity, then you have a fantastic resource for the formation of human lives. And unfortunately, in secular culture, and often in religious culture, these virtues are sometimes mentioned but not lived, and people have lost the sense also of how to communicate them from one generation to the next.
How much of a role then does education play in this?
Education is extremely important, particularly the education that consists not just in the passing on of information, but in the formation of ways of thinking and feeling and so on. If I move to my own sector, which is university education, though, by the way, while I've been here in Australia, I've been doing quite a lot of work in connection with schooling. I'm here as a guest of Scots College here in Sydney, and I've been doing quite a lot talking to their pupils and their teachers and so on, and other staff, but also in other places. But if I think about higher education, college and university, I think these have become corrupted by two things which people in them see as rather good. One is research, and the other is professional training. Now, when I say they're corrupted, what I mean by that, not is that research is a bad thing or that professional training is a bad thing. On the contrary, I think they're good things. But what they've squeezed out is education, right? The formation of the young. That's what colleges used to be about. Now they've come about the passing on of skills or enabling their staff to engage in research. Good as those things may be, that's not the primary purpose. The primary purpose is formation. And I would say that higher education has rather lost its way in that respect. The focus on skills, fine. The focus on people producing research, fine. But they exist primarily for the purpose of educating the young.
What is the resistance to that? Because it really is resistance to it, isn't it? Is it, as I suspect, this kind of ideal that we seem to have adopted of don't tell me how to live. So any of that sort of education is passing on wisdom, involves a certain amount of challenge to you to be a, to make the right sorts of choices.
Yeah.
People really resist that today.
That is true, partly because of the idea that it's for me to decide how to live my life and To which I would say, well, it is for you to decide how to live your life, but you better decide well, otherwise you'll have a bad kind of life. Now, did you want any advice on that? So, you know, anybody who's seriously interested in living their own life well is going to be somebody who's looking for answers to questions, and they're going to talk to others and so on. They're not going to think that they can just generate that out of themselves, or they ought not to think that. But the second thing, as far as higher education is concerned, is I just think that the institutions themselves and those who are employed within them have a vested interest in moving away from education, because professional training brings in a lot of money, right? And students want themselves to be able to earn a lot of money and so on, so they want to be trained up for employment. And then academics, they're in love with their subjects, which I perfectly well understand, and so they want to have as much time to get on with their own research. And teaching gets in the way of that. So I think it's a combination of those two things.
Do you consider yourself a virtuous person?
What an interesting question. I consider myself, as I would consider most human beings, to be a mix of good and bad. But I think that I'm very conscious of something that in the Christian tradition is written by one of the great figures in that tradition, St. Augustine. At one point he remarks, these are maybe not exactly his words, but they're his ideas, but I'm going to express it briefly in this way. He says that we suffer from a darkened intellect. We don't really fully understand what we need to understand. We suffer from a disturbance of the passions, that we're pulled hither and thither by our desires and appetites, and that we suffer from irresolution of the will. We find it difficult to do what we know we ought to do. And I find all of those three things to be recurrent in human lives, including my own.
This is Life and Faith, and we're bringing you a conversation with Catholic philosopher John Haldane on vice and virtue, self-love, optimism and pessimism, and the possibility of God.
Yes, and one of the things I made sure to ask him about was arguments for God. He's someone who believes it's possible to use reason to get you some way towards a case for the existence of God. And I wanted to know, what are the strongest elements of that approach and what are its chief weaknesses?
Well, maybe I'll start with the weaknesses and then move to the strengths. I think the weakness is maybe of two sorts, actually. One is there's the ambiguities of what we're going to call the evidence, right? The different things that might seem to be considerations in favour of God's existence are ambiguous in certain ways. So it might be unclear what exactly their implications are. And I think that's something we've come to appreciate more, really. Let's call this the ambiguity of the evidences, if I can put it that way. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing, I suppose, is what exactly they're evidence for. So here I think I'd need to draw a distinction between arguments or reasoning whose implications might be towards the existence of a something that is the cause of the universe, let's say, in distinction from arguments that might point to something very much more specific, you know, to a creative, loving God whose creation continues and who is providential, who's concerned with our welfare and wants to bring us to
those two things.
So we've got this, the abstract demonstration, if it is a demonstration, of the existence of something that is the ground and cause of the universe. And then on the other hand, we've got something like a personal God with various characteristics and attributes who is interested in, engaged with, and supportive of the human project, as it were. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the ambiguities on the one hand, and then, as it were, the gap between a very abstract conclusion and more specific conclusions. Because I think the abstract one, after all, really is in a way not that interesting. I mean, it might be significant, but it's very unclear what implications it has for human life. Mm-hmm. And then if I could just add a third thing now, as it occurs to me, is that I think that we have to be willing to think in terms of what I would call plausibility in the light of all considerations, as opposed to simple, clear, knockdown, you know, three-line arguments that just go in a straight line.
Yes.
So I think there are ambiguities. I think there's a question of the gap. And then there's the question of, it's not so much a matter of, you know, I write down on a piece of paper a single paragraph and hand it to you and there's the existence of God.
Mm.
It's more, as it were, bringing together a whole variety of things, experience, reflection, history, and then more sort of speculative arguments and so on, and then fitting all of those together. And then I think on the strength of that, one gets quite a good argument, actually, I think, not just to the existence of some sort of abstract principle or cause, but to something more personal.
Apart from those sorts of arguments, Are there others that people use and have used that you find particularly compelling?
Well, I suppose historically, really, there are three kinds of arguments, I would say, or three families of arguments. The first kind of argument is, in a way, the most basic, I suppose. It just says something like this. Look, the objects that we are familiar with in the world, I mean, whether they're man-made or whether they're natural objects and so on, or whether they're remote objects, galaxies, whether they're small or large and so on, none of these is self-explanatory. The existence of each of these things seems to be such that it might not have existed. It does exist, but it might not have existed. So it doesn't explain its own existence. And so we have to look for something that is the cause of the existence of something that might not have existed. Now, once we start on that inquiry, we realize that we'll never have an answer unless we arrive at something that is an uncaused cause of the existence of things, something whose own existence is not caused, is not due to something else, but from which the existence of other things flows. Now, this is sometimes called the cosmological argument, but you could just think of it as the basic existence argument. Things might not have existed, this thing might not have existed, that, and so on. Why do they exist? What's the cause of that? Mm-hmm. And then we start on this journey, and we realize we won't have an explanation until we come to something that is an uncaused cause of existence. And that, as they say, we call God. Second family of arguments is not from the mere existence of things, but from the character of things. So we might find order in the universe. We can maybe come back and say a little bit more about that in a minute. But at some level or levels, we might find order in the universe. And so here we argue that it's not just the existence of things that calls for an explanation, it's the order of things that calls for an explanation. And again, we might say, well, this order is imposed by something else. Yes, but the thing that imposed it, does it have order in and of itself, or is its order due to something else? And then we go back, and again, we need to come to something that is an ordered source of the order of other things. And then the third family of arguments, I would say, would be arguments from personal experience. These might be what we would think of as being religious experiences, but they might also be the experience of the ethical, that, as it were, one recognizes in other people something other than their mere animality, something that commands respect. We could call it human dignity, we could call it human value. And then we ask the question, how is it possible that there could be in this material universe things that have value? Well, an analogy here might be with artworks. You know, artworks are material objects, but that have a kind of value above and beyond their materiality. And we have an explanation of how that's possible, that they're invested with value by the artist who made them. And so again, we might think that human beings are invested with value by something that made them, not their parents, because then we go off again on the chase for who made them, but something that is a source of value and bestows that value upon other things.
Mm. Now, philosophical arguments are one thing.
Yes.
But what personal reasons do you have for being not just a philosopher, but also a believer? Can you describe something of that?
Well, I said earlier on that I think that, first of all, that there's a gap between the broadest philosophical arguments and something more substantial that really would engage with the human condition, human meaning, and so on. And I also said that I think that in the broader way of things, one has to think of something like a cumulative argument, or an argument or a way of thinking that integrates various aspects of experience, of historical knowledge, philosophical reflection, and so on and such like. Now, that's my perspective on this. I'm a Christian because I think that Christianity makes best sense of the totality of my experience and my knowledge. Now, that experience, some of that will be personal experience, my experience of my own life and the lives of others, of trying to make sense of my life and their lives. And that includes, of course, making sense of the bad as well as of the good,
yes.
Right? There's all of that. But then again, I think that history is extremely important. If we try to make sense of the sequence of human events, insofar as we have record of those, I think there are certain recurring patterns in human history. And I think these patterns point to something deep about the nature of human beings and their place in the universe. And then, of course, we've just mentioned the more philosophical arguments. And so my view would be something like this. If I consider the broad philosophical arguments, I think that those point, indicate, give us some reason to look beyond the world to find source of its being and of its order and of its character. But I think also if we look within the world and the sequence of events that constitute human history, I think we see significance and meaning there that points to something beyond the events themselves. And then if I look within my own life and the lives of others or in contemporary affairs and so on, I see things, recurrent features of the human condition that again call for a kind of explanation that's not provided by science or by psychology and so on. I'm not denigrating those, I'm just saying that they can tell us about, as it were, the structure of the world, but they don't tell us about the meaning of the world or the meaning of human experience.
And do you go from the philosophy to the history to the personal or the other way around?
Well, I would say it's more a matter of to-ing and fro-ing between them. I don't think anything's foundational in that way. And so I think of it more as these are kind of different areas or elements within one's broader view of the world. Think of one's perspective on the world. There's the scientific over here, there's the philosophical there, there's the experiential there, and so on. And it's more a matter of kind of going on the grand tour and revisiting and you know, coming to these and then experiencing them in the, and reflecting on them in the light of what one's previously experienced and reflected upon, and then moving and then coming back and so on. So it's a kind of to-ing and fro-ing between these different areas.
Because presumably, if your philosophical arguments don't at some point connect with your experience, they're probably a bit hollow.
I think so, yeah. I mean, they can sort of be rather elegant pieces of machinery, but they're just not engaging with things. So they're like sort of, you know, bits of a mechanism that whirs around and makes a lot of noise, but actually doesn't move anything else.
Right, right. Now, those are some of the things that have kind of contributed to your faith. What about the biggest challenges to your faith? Are they equally personal, historical, and philosophical?
Yes, I think so. So let's sort of work those through in the same way as we did the considerations in favour. So I think that the, I suppose, the deepest challenge is the problem of evil. Now, just to explain what I mean by this, we can think of evils as being of two different kinds, natural evils and moral evils. So there are the evils that people suffer, and there are the evils that people do, put it like that. Now, the evils that people suffer sometimes, of course, are the consequence of what people do, so they're connected with those moral evils. But there are also things like disease, you know. I mean, here in Australia, I spent time in the United States, and in the United States, in other parts of the world, recently in Greece, there are these terrible fires in which, you know, people's lives are lost, but beyond that, you know, property is destroyed. Whole communities are almost eradicated and so on. So there are these natural evils, I mean, and we can think of tsunamis and earthquakes, but we also think of disease and all of this. So the world is a place of suffering in many ways. And the obvious question is, how would a good, all-caring and all-knowing and all-powerful God permit that to happen, let alone cause it to happen? So that's one area. Then if I move to something like human history, one might say, well, look, if we look at human history, it hardly seems to be a sort of progressive ascent out of the darkness into the light, right? And once again, that raises questions, it seems to me, about the very idea of providence, of there being a caring, sharing, overseeing God. Isn't it just the chaos that you would expect in a random universe? And then, of course, I think in one's own life, something of that will recur, of course, chaos in one's own life. But I think that for many people, in terms of personal experience, as well as evil and disorder, there's the sense of the absence of God, there not being anything there, if I put it like that. And that's, to speak philosophically, that's sometimes put in terms of the hiddenness or the absence of God, that, you know, people of good intent might say, well, look, if there were a good God who cared for us and wanted us to know and to love him, wouldn't he reveal himself to us? So how come he's not apparent? So that idea of the unapparentness of God or the absence of God or the hiddenness of God is something that I think often erodes people's religious belief, or it prohibits them ever forming a religious belief in the first instance. So we've got the general problem of evil, we've got, as were, evil in human history and in human actions, and then we've got the, as it seems to many people, absence of any sense of there being a God.
I think sometimes people who are not believers imagine that the believer doesn't have those challenges. In fact, they are all things that the believer will wrestle with, including the hiddenness of God.
Precisely, yes. Yeah. I mean, my own view about that is that, you know, on deep reflection on these matters, they actually, not only are they compatible with the existence of God, but to some extent they point towards a certain account of God and God's relation to humankind and of humankind's state and condition, which is that this conflictedness that we feel, this uncertainty, this confusion and so on, is a reflection to some extent of our own alienation from God, and that may be something for which, in some sense, we are ourselves responsible. Now, when I say that, I think I'd want to distinguish between, as it were, personal problems, if I can put it that way, and structural problems. So some years ago, there was an investigation into the London Metropolitan Police concerning a certain crime and so on, and the conclusion was that this police force was structurally racist. Now, what that meant was, it wasn't a question of individual officers being racist, they might or they might not be, but that somehow racism had got into the climate, it was into the system, it was in the climate and so on. Now, I think that part of what, as it were, accounts for the hiddenness of God, or the seeming hiddenness of God and evil and so on in human life, is of that sort. It's not so much just what individuals do, it's kind of what's got into the system. Yeah. And I think that a system can remove itself or obscure itself from God in a way, just as it can with regard to other things. So, you know, I think we're very familiar with the fact that, you know, contemporary society has real problems of various kinds. Just think of the whole area of pornography, for example, or addictions of various kinds. These, I think, are sort of structural problems. And these stop people seeing the truth and living good lives. So I think that's a kind of an analogy for how it might be that human beings get themselves into a situation in which they kind of close themselves off to the possibility of the experience of God or the sense of God.
John, are you optimistic or pessimistic when you consider where we're going as a culture generally?
Well, in general terms, I think the lesson of human history is that there's no reason to be optimistic or pessimistic. Well, what I mean by that is this, that some people see the world as just getting worse and worse and worse, you know, and some people see the world as getting better and better and better. And I think that the lesson of human history is that sometimes it's bad and sometimes it's good, and sometimes it gets better and sometimes it gets worse. So the first mistake I think I want to identify is what I call presentism. And that's the emphasis on the present as being a particularly significant phase in human history. And people do this again and again and again. They think that somehow, you know, right now is really significant because we can see that right now, let's say, progressive politics, progressive thinking, progressive values are leading us upwards and onwards. We're escaping the darkness of the past. And sometimes people can think with regard to the very same present, well, this is really where the whole thing is falling apart. We can see disintegration. So what I'd say is I see aspects of both, but I think that optimism as a general view about things would be foolish, but equally pessimism as a general view about things is unwarranted as well. So not a simple answer, I'm afraid.
No. So the iPhone hasn't solved all our problems.
Quite.
This has been Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Simon's been speaking with philosopher John Haldane, who was in Australia as a guest of the Scots College in Sydney to deliver their annual Clark Lecture.
If you've enjoyed this conversation, please do leave us a rating or review and tell your friends about Life and Faith. That's the best way to spread the word. Next week,
I have Simon Smart and John Dixon here, and we're going to try to make some headway on this ethical dilemma of art versus material needs.
If you took that sort of logic, you'd never sit with a small child and read them a beautiful story. You wouldn't knit them a blanket.
Even have a child. If you really took this seriously, you'd go, hang on, every kid's going to cost me $200,000 by the time I kick them out of the house, so I should save that $200,000 and give it to World Vision. There you go.